married. He was 39 years old to my 19, and I was with him 16 years. I knew that man. He didn't kill himself. He wouldn't do that to me.
What makes you so sure?
What makes you sure the sun's coming up in the east every day? It just does, that's all, and you learn to count on that the way I learned to count on him.
You think somebody killed him?
Of course I do. Lance Wood did it, as sure as I'm sitting here. But he's not going to admit it in a million years, and neither will his family. Have you talked to them?
Some, I said. I heard about Hugh's death for the first time yesterday.
I always figured they paid off the cops to keep it hush. They got tons of money, and they know everyone in town. It was a cover-up.
Lyda, these are honorable people you're talking about. They'd never tolerate murder, and they wouldn't protect Lance if they thought he had anything to do with it.
Boy, you're dumber than I am if you believe that. I'm telling you, it was murder. Why'd you fly all this way if you didn't think so yourself?
I don't know what to think. That's why I'm asking you.
Well, it wasn't suicide. He wasn't depressed. He wasn't the suicidal type. Why would he do such a thing? That's just dumb.
They knew him. They knew what kind of man he was. I watched her carefully. I heard he was planning to leave the company and start a business of his own.
He talked about that. He talked about a lot of things. He worked for Woody 15 years. Hugh was loyal as they come, but everybody knew the old man meant to leave the company to Lance. Hugh couldn't stand the idea. He said Lance was a boob and he didn't want to be around to watch him mess up.
Did the two of them have words?
I don't know for sure. I know he gave notice and Woody talked him out of it. He just bid on a big government contract, and he needed Hugh. I guess Hugh said he'd stay until word came through whether Woody got the bid or not. 2 days later, I got home from work, opened the garage door, and there he was. It looked like he fell asleep in the car, but his skin was cherry red. I never will forget that.
There's no way it could have been an accident.
She leaned forward earnestly. I said it once, and I'll say it again. Hugh wouldn't kill himself. He didn't have a reason, and he wasn't depressed.
How do you know he wasn't holding something back?
I guess I don't, if you put it like that.
The notion of murder doesn't make any sense. Lance wasn't even in charge at that point, and he wouldn't kill an employee just because the guy wants to move on. That's ludicrous.
Lyda shrugged, undismayed by my skepticism. Maybe Lance worried Hugh would take the business with him when he went.
Well, aside from the fact he wasn't gone yet, it still seems extreme. She bristled slightly.
You asked for my opinion. I'm telling you what I think.
I can see you believe it, but it's going to take more than that to talk me into it. If Hugh was murdered, it could have been someone else, couldn't it?
Of course it could. I believe it was Lance, but I can't swear to it. I don't have any proof anyhow. Sometimes I think it's not worth fooling with. It's over and done, so what difference does it make?
I shifted the subject. Why'd you have him cremated so fast? She stared at me.
Are you thinking I had a hand in it?
I'm just asking the questions. What do I know?
He asked to be cremated. It wasn't even my idea. He'd been dead for 2 days. The coroner released the body, and the funeral director suggested we go ahead with it, so I took his advice. You can talk to him yourself if you don't believe me, she said. You was drugged. I bet money that's how they pulled it off. His lab work was stolen so nobody'd see the test results.
Maybe he was drunk, I suggested. He might have pulled into the garage and fallen asleep. She shook her head.
He didn't drink. He'd given that up.
Did he have a problem with alcohol?
Once upon a time he did, she said. We met in a bar. 2 in the afternoon in the middle of the week. He wasn't even traveling. He just liked to come watch the planes, he said. I should have suspected right then, but you know what it's like when you fall in love. You see what you want to see. It took me years to figure out how far gone he was. Finally, I said I'd leave him if he didn't straighten up. He went into this program. Not AA, but something similar. He got sobered up, and that's how he stayed.
Is there a chance he'd gone back to drinking? It wouldn't be unheard of.
Not with him on antabuse. He'd have been sick as a pup.
You sure he took the stuff?
I gave it to him myself. It was like a little game we played, every morning with his orange juice. He held his hand out, and I gave him his pill and watched him swallow it right down. He wanted me to see he didn't cheat. He swore the day he quit drinking he'd never go back to it.
How many people knew about the antabuse?
I don't know. He never made a big deal of it. If people around him were drinking, he just said no thanks.
Tell me what was happening the week he died.
Nothing. It seemed like an ordinary week to me. He talked to Woody. 2 days later, he was dead. After the funeral, I packed up, put everything in a U-Haul, and hit the road for home.
This is where I've been ever since.
And there was nothing among his things to suggest what was going on? No letter? A note?
She shook her head.
I went through his desk the day he died, and I didn't see a thing.
Chapter 12. The flight home was uneventful. I'd spent an hour and a half with Lida, and the rest of the night in the airport terminal, with its red carpeting, high glass ceiling, real trees, and an actual bird that flew back and forth, chirping incessantly. It was sort of like camping out, only I was sitting upright, and I didn't have any weenies to roast. I made notes of my conversation with Lida, which I'd transcribed for the files when I got home. I was inclined to believe Hugh Case had been murdered, though I had no idea how, why, or by whom. I also tended to think his death was related to current events at Wood Warren, though I couldn't imagine what the connection might be. Lida had promised to get in touch if she remembered anything of note. All in all, it was not an unproductive trip. It had generated more questions than it answered, but that was fine with me. As long as there are threads to unravel, I'm in business. The frustration starts when all the leads dry up and the roads turn out to be dead ends. With Hugh Case, I felt like I just found one of the corner pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. I had no idea what the final picture would look like, but at least I had a place to start. I boarded the plane at 4:30 a.m. and arrived at LAX at 5:45. I had to wait for a 7 o'clock a.m. shuttle to Santa Teresa, and by the time I dragged my sorry ass home, I was dead on my feet. I let myself into the apartment an hour later, checked for messages, none, pulled my boots off, and curled up in the folds of my quilt, fully dressed. At approximately 9:02, there was a knock at my door. I staggered up out of sleep and shuffled to the door, dragging my quilt behind me like a bridal train. My mouth tasted foul, and my hair was standing straight up, as spiky as a punker's, only not as clean. I peered through the fisheye, too clever to be caught unawares by an early morning thug. Standing on my doorstep was my second ex-husband, Daniel Wade. "Shit," I murmured. Briefly, I leaned my head against the door and then peeked again. All I could see in truncated form was his face and profile, blonde hair curling around his head like an aura. Daniel Wade is quite possibly the most beautiful man I've ever seen. A bad sign. Beautiful men are usually either gay or impossibly narcissistic. Sorry for the generalization, folks, but it's the truth. I like a good face, or an interesting face, or a face with character, but not this sculpted perfection of his. The straight, well-proportioned nose, high cheekbones, strong jawline, sturdy chin. His hair was sun-bleached, his eyes a remarkable shade of blue, offset by dark lashes. His teeth were straight and very white, his smile slightly crooked. Get the picture, troops? I opened the door. Yes. Hi. Hello. I gave him a rude stare, hoping he'd disappear. He's tall and slim, and he can eat anything without gaining weight. He stood there in faded jeans and a dark red sweatshirt with the sleeves pushed up. His skin had a golden sheen, tanned and windburn, so his cheeks glowed darkly.
Just another boring California golden boy. The hair on his arms was bleached nearly white. His hands were tucked in his pockets, which was just as well. He's a jazz pianist with long, bony fingers. I fell in love with his hands first and then worked my way up. I've been in Florida. Good voice, too. Just in case his other virtues fail to excite. Reedy and low. He sings like an angel, plays six instruments. What brought you back? I don't know. Homesick, I guess. A friend of mine was heading this way, so I tagged a ride. Did I wake you up? No, I often walk around looking like this. A slight smile here, perfectly timed. His manner seemed hesitant, which was unusual for him. He was searching the sight of me, looking, perhaps, for some evidence of the girl I used to be. I like the haircut, he said. Gee, this is fun. I like yours, too. I guess I caught you at a bad time. I'm sorry about that. Daniel, could we skip to the punchline here? I'm operating on an hour's sleep, and I feel like shit. It was clear he'd rehearsed this whole conversation, but in his mind, my response was tender instead of downright rude. I wanted you to know I'm clean, he said. I have been for a year. No drugs, no drinking. It hasn't been easy, but I really have straightened up. Super, I'm thrilled. It's about bloody time. Could you knock off the sarcasm? That's my natural way of speaking ever since you left. It's real popular with men. He rocked slightly on his heels, looking off across the yard.
I guess people don't get a second chance with you.
I didn't respond to that. He tried a new tack.
Look, I have a therapist named Elise. She was the one who suggested I clean up the unfinished business in my life. She thought maybe you might benefit, too.
Oh, hey, that's swell. Give me her address and I'll write her a bread-and-butter note.
Can I come in?
Jesus Christ, Daniel, of course not. Don't you get it? I haven't seen you for 8 years, and it turns out that's not long enough.
How can you be so hostile after all this time? I don't feel bad about you.
Why would you feel bad? I didn't do anything to you. A look of injury crossed his face, and his bewilderment seemed genuine. There's a certain class of people who will do you in and then remain completely mystified by the depth of your pain. He shifted his weight. This apparently wasn't going as he thought it would. He reached up to pick at a wood splinter in the doorframe above my head.
I didn't think you'd be bitter. That's not like you, Kinsey. We had some good years.
Year? Singular. 11 months and 6 days, to be exact. You might move your hand before I slam the door on it.
He moved his hand. I slammed the door and went back to bed.
After a few minutes, I heard the gate squeak. I thrashed about for a while, but it was clear I wouldn't get back to sleep. I got up and brushed my teeth, showered, shampooed my hair, shaved my legs. I used to have fantasies about his showing up. I used to invent long monologues in which I poured out my sorrow and my rage. Now I was wishing he'd come back again so I could do a better job of it. Being rejected is burdensome that way. You're left with emotional baggage you unload on everyone else. It's not just the fact of betrayal, but the person you become. Usually not very nice. Jonah had survived my tartness. He seemed to understand it had nothing to do with him. He was so blunt himself that a little rudeness didn't bother him. For my part, I really thought I'd made my peace with the past until I came face to face with it. I called Olive Kohler and made an appointment to see her later in the day. Then I sat down at my desk and typed up my notes. At noon, I decided to get some errands done. Daniel was sitting in a car parked just behind mine. He was slouched down in the passenger seat, his booted feet propped up on the dashboard, a cowboy hat tilted over his face. The car was a 10-year-old Pinto, dark blue, dented, rusted, and stripped of its hubcaps. The sheepskin car seat covers looked like badly matted dog. A decal on the bumper indicated that the car was from Rent-A-Ruin. Daniel must have heard the gate squeak as I came out. He turned his head, pushing his hat back lazily. He sometimes affects that aw shucks attitude.
Feeling better, Miss Kitty?
I unlocked my car and got in, started the engine and pulled away. I avoided the apartment for the rest of the day. I can't remember now half of what I did. Mostly I wasted time and resented the fact that I was not only out at an office, but banned from my own residence. At 5 o'clock, with the aid of a street map, I found the Kohler's house on an obscure leafy lane in Montebello. The property was hidden by a 10-foot hedge, the driveway barred by an electronically controlled wrought-iron gate. I parked out on the street and let myself in through a wooden gate embedded in the shrubbery. The house was a two-story English Tudor style, with a steeply pitched shingle roof, half-timbered gables, and a handsome pattern of vertical beams across the front. The lot was large, shaded with sycamores and eucalyptus trees as smooth and gray as bare concrete. Dark green ivy seemed to grow everywhere. A gardener, a graduate of the Walt Disney School of Landscape Maintenance, was visible, trimming the shrubs into animal shapes. The newspaper was resting on the doormat. I picked it up and then I rang the bell. I expected a maid, but Olive opened the door herself in a gray satin robe and low-heeled satin mules. I'd mostly seen those in Joan Crawford movies, and they looked like they'd be a trick to wear. I had brief visions of plopping around my apartment in backless bedroom slippers, cigarette holder, marcelled hair. I could have my eyebrows plucked back to OG arches.
Hello, Kinsey. Come in. Terry's on his way. I forgot we were due at a cocktail party at 6.
She stepped away from the door, and I followed her in.
"We can do this another time if you like," I said. I handed her the paper. "Thanks, no, this is fine. It's not for an hour anyway, and the people don't live far. I've got to finish dressing, but we can talk in here."
She glanced at the paper briefly and then tossed it on the hall table next to a pile of mail. She clattered her way along the dark stone-tile hallway toward the master suite at the rear of the house. Olive was slim and blonde, her shoulder-length hair blunt-cut and thick. I wondered sometimes if Ash was the only sister whose hair remained its natural shade. Olive's eyes were bright blue, her lashes black, her skin tone gold. She was 33 or so, not as brittle as Epony, but with none of Ash's warmth. She was talking back over her shoulder to me.
"I haven't seen you for 10 years. What have you been up to?"
"Setting up my own agency," I said.
"Married? Kids?"
"No, on both counts. You have kids?"
She laughed. "God forbid."
The bedroom we entered was spacious. Beamed ceiling, big stone fireplace, French doors opening onto a walled-in patio, where a small deck had been added on. I could see a round two-person hot tub surrounded by ferns. A white Persian cat was curled up on a chaise, its face tucked into the circling plume of its tail. The bedroom floor was polished teak, with area rugs of a long white wool that probably came from yaks. The entire wall behind the bed was mirrored, and I flashed on an image of Terry Kohler's sexual performances. What did Olive stare at, I wondered, while he watched himself? I glanced at the ceiling, checking to see if there was a cartoon tacked up there, like the one in my gynecologist's examining room. "Smile. It gives your face something to do." This does not amuse. I eased into an easy chair and watched while Olive moved into a walk-in closet the size of a two-car garage. Quickly, she began to sort through a rack of evening clothes, rejecting sequined outfits, floor-length organza gowns, beaded jackets with long matching skirts. I could see an assortment of shoes stacked in clear plastic boxes on the shelf overhead, and at one end of the rack several fur coats of various lengths and types. She selected a knee-length cocktail dress with spaghetti straps and returned to the bedroom where she scrutinized her reflection. The dress was avocado green, infusing her skin with sallow undertones.
"What do you think?"
she said, eyes still pinned to her own image in the glass.
"Makes you look green."
She stared at herself, squinting critically.
"You're right. Here, you take this. I never liked it anyway."
She tossed the dress on the bed.
"I don't wear clothes like that," I said uncomfortably. "Take it. We'll have a New Year's Eve party, and you can wear it then."
She pulled out a black taffeta dress cut straight across the front. She stepped into it, then zipped it up the back in a motion that snapped everything into place. She was so slender I didn't see how the globe-like breasts could possibly be hers. She looked like she'd had softballs surgically implanted on her chest. Hug a woman like that, and she was bound to leave dents. She sat down on the dressing table bench and pulled on black pantyhose, then slipped her feet into 4-inch black spike heels. She looked gorgeous, all curves and flawless skin, the pale blonde hair brushing against her bare shoulders. She sorted through her jewelry box and selected clip-on diamond earrings, shaped like delicate silver branches hung with sparkling fruit. She returned to the closet and emerged in a soft white fur coat the same length as the dress. When she pulled the coat around her, she looked like a flasher decked out in white fox. She half-smiled when she caught my look.
"I know what you're thinking, sweetie, but they were already dead when I got to the furriers. Whether or not I bought the coat had no effect on their fates."
"If women didn't wear them, they wouldn't be killed in the first place," I said.
"Oh, bullshit. Don't kid yourself. In the wild, these animals get torn to shreds every day. Why not preserve the beauty like a piece of art? The world's a vicious place. I don't pretend otherwise. And don't argue with me," she said firmly. She pointed a finger. "You came to talk, so talk."
She slipped the coat off and tossed it on the bed, then sat down on the bench and crossed her legs. She eased off one high heel and let her shoe flap against the bottom of her foot. I said,
"How much do you know about the situation at Wood Warren?"
She gestured impatiently.
"Business is a bore. I use that section of the paper to line the cat box."
"You have no interest in the family split?"
"What split? You mean with Lance?"
"I have nothing invested one way or the other. He and Ebony disagree. She wants me to vote with her. The way she explains it, it's to my advantage.
Lance will have a fit, of course, but who gives a shit? He's had his chance. You're siding with her? Who knows, probably. She's smarter than he is, and it's time for new blood. He's got his head in the toilet half the time. Meaning what? Let me give you the lowdown on my brother, Honeybun. He's a salesman at heart. He can charm your socks off when it suits him. He's enthusiastic about anything that interests him, which isn't much. He has no head for figures. Absolutely none. He hates sitting in an office, and he can't stand routine. He's good at generating business and lousy at follow-through. End transmission. You've seen this firsthand, or is this Ebony's claim? I hear about what happens at the plant every day. Terry's a workaholic, and most of what he talks about is business. How do he and Lance get along? They knock heads all the time. Terry's obsessive. It drives him crazy when people fuck up. Excuse the scientific term. Lance has poor judgment. Everyone knows that. Meet the woman he married, if you have any doubts. What about the rest of the family? Can't they vote him out? Nope. The rest of us combined only own 49% of the stock. Ebony wants to put the squeeze on him, but she can't actually force him out. She can bring him to heel, which I suspect is what she wants. I take it Baz isn't involved since he lives in New York. He shows up for board meetings occasionally. He enjoys playing mogul, but he's harmless enough. He and Lance are usually thick. Who will Ashley side with? She could go either way. Obviously, Ebony's hoping she can persuade us all to mutiny. How does your mother feel? This couldn't sit well with her. She hates it. She wants Lance in charge, not because he's good, but because it's less hassle. Do you think he's honest? Lance, are you kidding? No way. How do you and he get along? I can't stand him. He's a very tense person, and he's so paranoid. I hate to be around him. He gets on my nerves. He's my brother, and I love him. Don't get me wrong. I just don't like him much. She wrinkled her nose. He always smells like garlic and sweat and that nasty brute cologne. I don't know why men wear it. Such a turn-off. Have you heard any gossip about the warehouse blaze? Just what Terry's told me. You know Lance borrowed money against the company 2 years ago, and now he's losing his shirt. He'd love $500,000. Oh, really? That's the first I heard of it. She shrugged carelessly. He went into the printing business, which is foolish in itself. I've heard printing in restaurants are the quickest way to go broke. He's lucky the warehouse burned down. Or is that the point? Why don't you tell me? She rested her elbow on her knee and propped her chin up on her fist. If you're looking for answers, I've just run out. I don't care about Lance. I don't care about Wood Warren, to tell you the truth. Sometimes the politics amuse me in a soap opera kind of way, like Dynasty. But it's still boring stuff. What do you care about? Tennis, travel, clothes, golf. What else is there? Sounds like a fun life. Actually, it is. I entertain. I do charity work when I have the time. There are people who think I'm a spoiled, lazy bitch, but I have what I want. That's more than most can say. It's the have-nots who wreak havoc. I'm a real pussycat. You're fortunate. Like they say, there's no such thing as a free ride. I pay a price, believe me. I could see what an exhausting proposition that must be. We heard someone at the entrance, then footsteps along the hall. By the time Terry Kohler reached the bedroom door, he was already in the process of removing his coat and tie. Hello, Kinsey. Olive mentioned you'd be stopping by. Let me grab a quick shower and then we can talk. He looked at Olive. Could you fetch us a drink? He said, his tone peremptory. She didn't exactly perk up and pant, but that's the impression she gave. Maybe her job was harder than I thought. I wouldn't do that for anyone. Chapter 13. I waited in the living room while Olive stepped into the kitchen. The place was handsome. Beveled window panes, pecan paneling, a fieldstone fireplace, traditional furniture in damask and mahogany. Everything was rose and dusty pink. The room smelled faintly spicy, like carnations. I couldn't imagine the two of them sitting here doing anything. Aside from the conventional good taste, there was no indication that they listened to music or read books. No evidence of shared interests. There was a current copy of Architectural Digest on the coffee table, but it looked like a prop. I've never known rich people to read Popular Mechanics, Family Circle, or Road and Track. Come to think of it, I have no idea what they do at night. Olive returned in 10 minutes with a tray of hors d'oeuvres and a silver cooler with a wine bottle nestled in ice. Her entire manner had changed since Terry walked in the door. She still had an air of elegance, but her manner was tinged now with servitude. She fussed with small linen cocktail napkins, arranging them in a pattern near the serving plate she'd placed at one end of the coffee table. She'd prepared ripe figs, stuffed with mascarpone cheese, triangles of phyllo, and chilled new potato halves topped with sour cream and caviar. If I called this my dinner, would all of my nutritional needs be met? Olive crossed briskly to a sideboard and set out liquor bottles so we'd have a choice of drinks. The room was beginning to darken, and she turned on 2 table lamps. The panels of her taffeta skirt made a silky scritching sound every time she moved. Her legs were well muscled, and the spike heels threw her calves into high relief. I glanced over to see Terry standing in the doorway, freshly showered and dressed, his gaze lingering on the picture she presented. He caught my eye, smiling with the barest suggestion of proprietorship. He didn't look like an easy man to please. "Gorgeous house," I said. Olive looked over with a rare smile. "Thanks," she said. "Have a seat," he said. "I don't want to hold you up." Terry waved dismissively, as if the pending conversation took precedence. The gesture had the same ingratiating effect as someone who tells his secretary to hold all the calls. It's probably bullshit. Maybe no one ever calls anyway, but it gives the visitor a feeling of importance. "He'd never pass up a chance to talk business," Olive said. She handed him a martini and then glanced at me. "What would you like?" "The white wine, if I may." While I looked on, she opened the bottle, pouring a glass for me and then one for herself. She handed me mine and then eased out of her shoes and took a seat on the couch, tucking her feet up under her. She seemed softer, less egotistical. The role of helpmeet suited her, which surprised me somehow. She was a woman who had no apparent purpose beyond indulging herself and pampering her man. The notion seemed outdated in a world of career women and supermoms. Terry perched on the arm of the couch, staring at me with guarded interest. He took charge of the conversation, a move he must have been accustomed to. His dark eyes gave his narrow face a brooding look, but his manner was pleasant. He made only an occasional digital reference to the fact of his mustache. I've seen men who stroke their facial hair incessantly, as if it were the last remnant of a baby bunting, comforting and soft. "Lance says someone tried to frame you," he said. He ate a new potato half and passed the plate to me. "Looks that way," I said. I helped myself to a fig. Heaven on the tongue.
"What do you need from us?"
"For starters, I'm hoping you can fill me in on Ava Doherty."
"Ava? Sure. What's she got to do with it?"
"She was there the day I did the fire scene inspection. She also saw Heather give me the envelope full of inventory sheets, which have since disappeared." His gaze shifted, and I watched him compose his reply before he spoke.
"As far as I know, Ava's straight as an arrow, hard-working, honest, devoted to the company."
"What about Lance? How does she get along with him?"
"I've never heard them exchange a cross word. He's the one who hired her, as a matter of fact, when it was clear we needed an office manager."
"How long ago was that?"
"God, it must be 2-3 years now," he said.
He looked down at Olive, sitting close by.
"What's your impression? Am I reporting accurately?"
Olive shrugged. "Well, I wouldn't say she's crazy about him. She thinks he plays too much when he ought to be getting work done, but I don't think she'd devise any scheme to do him in." Olive passed the hors d'oeuvre tray to me. I thought it only gracious to sample something else, so I selected a potato half and popped it in my mouth. "Who might?" I asked, licking sour cream from my thumb. This shit was great. If they'd just leave the room for a minute, I'd have a go at the rest. Both seemed to come up blank. "Come on, he must have enemies. Somebody's gone to a lot of trouble over this," I said. Terry said,
"At the moment I couldn't name one, but we can give it some thought. Maybe something will occur to us."
"What can you tell me about the Wood Warren engineer who killed himself?" "Hugh Case," Olive said. Terry seemed surprised.
"What brought that up? I just got a call from Lida Case this afternoon."
"Really?" I said. "What did she have to say?"
"It wasn't what she said so much as her attitude.
She was completely freaked out, screaming at the top of her lungs, said his death was my fault.
Olive looked at him in disbelief.
Yours? What bullshit? Why would she say that?
I have no idea. She sounded drunk, ranting and raving, foul-mouthed, shrill.
That's curious, I said. Is she here in town? Terry shook his head.
She didn't say. The call was long distance from the sound of it. Where's she live?
Dallas, I believe.
I got the impression she intended to fly out. Do you want to talk to her if she shows up?
Yes, I'd like that, I said, careful to omit any reference to the fact that I'd met with her the night before. She hadn't seemed paranoid to me at all, and she'd never mentioned Terry's name.
Olive stirred on the couch, shifting positions. Just in time for New Year's. Everyone will be here.
She glanced at Terry.
Did I tell you Bass gets in tonight?
A look of annoyance flashed across his face.
I thought he was broke. I hope you didn't pay his way.
Me? Absolutely not. Ebony sends him money, but you wouldn't catch me doing it, she remarked. And then to me, Bass and I had a falling out at Thanksgiving, and we haven't spoken since. He's got a big mouth in matters that are none of his business. I think he's loathsome, and he's just about that fond of me.
Terry glanced at his watch, and I took that as my cue.
I should let you go if you've got a party, I said. I don't feel we've been any help, Olive said.
Don't worry about it. I've got other sources. Just let me know if you come up with anything you think might pertain. I left my card on the coffee table. Terry walked me to the door while Olive excused herself to fetch her coat. He watched her disappear into the bedroom.
I didn't want to mention this in front of her, he said, but Lyda Case scared the hell out of me this afternoon.
How so?
I don't want to make Olive nervous, but the woman threatened me. I don't think it has anything to do with Lance, or I'd have said so up front. This is different. I don't know what it's about, but she really sounded cracked.
What kind of threat? I asked.
Out of nowhere, she asked me how old I'd be on my next birthday. I don't know what she was getting at, but when I told her I'd be 46, she said, don't count on it. And then she laughed like a fiend. Jesus, the sound made my blood run cold. I can't believe she was serious, but my God, what a thing to say.
And you have no idea why she suddenly got in touch?
I haven't talked to her for years. Since Hugh died, I guess.
I understand there's some question about the manner of his death.
I've heard that, too, and I don't know what to think.
How well did you know him?
I wouldn't say we were close, but I worked with him, oh, probably 5 years or so. He never struck me as the sort who'd commit suicide. Of course, you never know what someone under pressure will do.
Pressure?
Lyda'd threatened to leave him. Hugh was a sweet guy, but he was terribly dependent on her, and I think it just knocked the props out from under him.
Why was she leaving? What was that about?
I wasn't privy to the details. Lance might know.
Olive reappeared, white fur coat across her shoulders, the green dress over her arm. Terry and I abandoned the topic of Lyda Case. He made no comment when she gave me the dress. Maybe Olive always gave away her clothes. The three of us left the house together, confining ourselves to small talk. It was fully dark by then, and the night was chilly. I turned on the heater in my car and drove to a payphone in Montebello Village, putting a call in to Darcy at home. I wanted to stop off and see her before I went back to my place, but she told me Andy'd worked late, so she hadn't had a chance to search his office. She was going in early the next morning and said she'd call if she came up with anything. I hung up, realizing then how exhausted I felt. In addition to the jet lag, I was operating on a bad night's sleep, and the fragmentary nap I'd picked up this morning wasn't helping anything. I headed home. As I turned the corner onto my street, I spotted Daniel's rental car still sitting at the curb in front of my apartment. I parked and got out. Even in the dark, I could see him slouched in the front, feet on the dash as they had been before. I was just opening the gate when he rolled down his window.
"Can I talk to you?"
I felt something snappish rise up in me, but I forced it back down again. I don't like being bitchy, and I hated admitting to myself that he still had the power to distress. "All right," I said. I approached the car and halted about 6 feet away. "What is it?" He unfolded himself and emerged from the car, leaning his elbows on the open car door. The pale glow from the streetlight gilded his cheekbones, touching off strands of silver in the cloud of blonde hair.
"I'm in a bit of a bind," he said.
His face was dappled with shadows that masked the remembered clear blue of his eyes. After 8 years, it was amazingly painful just to be in his company. I thought the safest course was to repeat information back to him without comment. "You're in a bind," I said. There was a brief silence wherein I assumed I was meant to quiz him on the nature of his problem. I clamped my teeth together, waiting. He smiled ruefully.
"Don't worry. I'm not going to ask you for money, and I'm not trying to get in your pants."
"This comes as a big relief, Daniel. What do you want?" The bitchy tone was already back, but I swear I couldn't help myself. There's nothing more infuriating than a man who's manipulated your emotions once and now thinks he can do it again. I could still remember the charge that ran between us early in our relationship, sexual electricity infusing the very air we breathed. It had taken years for me to realize that I had generated most of it myself out of my own neediness. Maybe that's what was making me so churlish in retrospect. I was still chafing at myself for what a fool I'd been.
"I need a place to stash my gear," he said.
"What gear?" He shrugged.
"I got a $2,000 acoustic guitar I can't leave because the trunk lock is busted on the rental car I picked up. It'll get ripped off if it's in the back seat."
"You brought a guitar like that all the way from Florida?"
"I thought maybe I'd pick up a gig out here. I could use the bucks."
"What happened to your friend? I thought you got a ride with someone. Why not take it to his place? Or is it a woman? I guess I never asked you that."
"Well, no, it's a guy," he said. "The problem is, he doesn't actually live here in town. He was just passing through on his way to San Francisco, and he won't be back till late on Sunday. That's why I had to rent a car of my own."
"Where are you staying? Don't you have a place?"
"I'm working on that. The town's booked solid because of the holidays. Meantime, I can't even pull into a gas station to take a leak without hauling everything in with me. It's just for a couple of days."
I stared at him. "You always do things like this, you know that? You're always in a bind, shifting your weight from foot to foot, hoping someone'll bail you out of the hole you're in. Try the rescue mission. Pick up a woman. That shouldn't be so tough. Or sell the damn thing. Why is it up to me?"
"It's not up to you," he said mildly. "It's a simple favor. What's the big deal?"
I ran out of steam. We'd had this same exchange 100 times, and he'd never heard me before. I might as well save my breath. I might as well give him what he wanted and get it over with. It was probably just an elaborate excuse to prolong our contact. "Never mind," I said. "No big deal. You can park the damn thing in a corner until Sunday, and then I want it out of here."
"Sure. No problem. Thanks."
"I'm warning you, Daniel. If you've got a stash anywhere within 6 blocks of here, I'll call the cops."
"I'm clean. I told you that." "You can look for yourself."
"Skip it," I said. I knew him well enough to know he wouldn't bluff on that, because he knew me well enough to know I'd have him thrown in the slammer if I caught him.
End of Disc 3. Disc 4.
Chapter 14. I took a couple of Tylenols and slept like a stone, deep, dreamless sleep that soothed my frazzled nerves and restored my good spirits. I was up at 6 o'clock, ready to jog as usual. There was no sign of Daniel parked at my curb. I did a perfunctory stretch against the fence post and headed toward Cabana Boulevard. The run felt great. The sky was a pearl gray streaked with pink. To my right, a dark gray surf boomed against the hard-packed sand, leaving snowy froth in its wake. The wharf was mirrored in the glistening pools that remained when the waves receded. The sea seemed to shush the birds that shrieked overhead. This was the last day of the year, and I ran with a sense of optimism the new year always brings. I'd find a way to sort it all out. Lance, Mac's suspicions about me, even Daniel's sudden appearance on my doorstep. I was alive and healthy, physically fit. Rosie's would open again on Monday. Henry would be home in another 6 days. I had the sassy green dress Olive had given me, and maybe a New Year's invitation if she came through as hoped. I did my 3 miles and slowed to a walk, cooling off as I headed home. I showered and dressed in jeans as usual, savoring the morning at home. By then it was 7 o'clock, too early for phone calls. I ate my cereal and read the L.A. Times over 2 cups of coffee. Daniel's guitar sat in the corner in mute testimony to his renewed presence in my life, but I ignored it for the most part. Darcy called at 7:35 from California Fidelity. She'd done a thorough search. Andy's office was clean. "Shit," I said. "What about a typewriter? I was hoping we could get a match on the phony fire department report, but I didn't find one at his apartment."
"Maybe he keeps it in the trunk of his car."
"Oh, I like that. I'll see if I can find a way to check that out." "In the meantime, keep an eye peeled. Maybe something will surface. Andy's got to be tied into this business somehow. It would help a lot to know who he knows at Wood Warren. Did you go through his Rolodex?"
"That won't help. He knows all those guys because that was his account. He's bound to have the number handy. I'll check it out, though. Maybe something else will come to light."
She clicked off. At 8 o'clock, I put a call through to Lida Case in Texas. Her roommate said she was out of town, maybe in California, but she wasn't sure. I left my number and asked her to have Lida get in touch with me if she called home. I called my pal at the credit bureau, but she was out until Monday. I had the feeling the rest of the day was going to come down about the same way. It was New Year's Eve day. As with Christmas Eve, businesses were closing early, people taking off at noon. Olive called me at 10 o'clock to say that she was indeed putting together an impromptu cocktail party. "It's mostly family and a few close friends. Half the people I called already had plans. Are you free? We'd love to have you if you're not already tied up." "Of course I'm not," I said. "I'd love to come." I hated to sound so eager, but in truth I was. I didn't want to spend this New Year's Eve alone. I was worried Daniel might start looking good, too. "Can I bring anything?"
"Actually, I could use some help," she said.
"I gave the housekeeper the weekend off, keeper, the weekend off, keeper, so I'm throwing the whole thing together by myself. I can always use an extra set of hands." "Well, I'm not a cook, but I can sure chop and stir. What time?"
4:30. I'll be back from the supermarket by then. Ash said she'd come about 5 to help, too. Everybody else will be coming about 7. We'll keep going till the food and alcohol give out."
"Great," I said. "And the green dress will be okay?"
"It better be. I'm giving this party so you can wear the damn thing."
I put a call through to Lance. I didn't like initiating the contact with him, but I had to hear his version of the situation with Hugh Case. As soon as he was on the line, I told him what I'd heard. The silence was weighty. "Lance?" "I'm here," he said. He sighed heavily. "Jesus, I don't know how to deal with this. What the hell is going on? I heard rumors back then she thought I had something to do with his death. It's not true. It's completely untrue. But I don't have a way of proving it. Why would I do that? What could I possibly gain by killing him?"
"Wasn't he leaving the company?"
"Absolutely not. He talked about quitting. He said he wanted to start a company of his own. He even gave notice, but hell, Dad called him in and they had a long talk. Dad offered to make him a vice president, give him a big raise, and he was happy as a clam."
"When was this?"
"I don't know, a couple of days before he died."
"Didn't that strike you as peculiar?"
"Sure it did. She swore he didn't kill himself, and I agreed. He wasn't the depressive type, and he just made a hell of a deal for himself. Somehow she got it in her head that I killed the man. I wouldn't harm a soul. You gotta believe me. Somebody's working very hard to get me put away."
"Speaking of which, have you heard anything from California Fidelity?"
His tone changed. "Yeah, yesterday. They're turning everything over to the cops."
I could feel my stomach clench.
"Really? Do they have enough to make a case?" "I don't know. I hope not. Look, I need to talk to you privately, and I can't do it here. It's important. Is there any way we can meet?" I told him I'd be at Olive's later, and we agreed to talk then. I wasn't anxious to be seen in his company, but he seemed insistent, and at that point I didn't see how things could get worse. I wasn't guilty of conspiracy, and I was tired of acting like I was. Worry was sitting in my chest like a weight, leaden and oppressive. I had to do something to get my mind off things. I went out and bought a pair of high heels, anxiety translating into excitement as the day progressed. Being isolated that week had made me aware that I do have a few social impulses, buried deep, perhaps, under layers of caution, but part of me nevertheless. This was like dress-up time with the big kids, and I was looking forward to it. I'd begun to feel very charitable about Olive, whose lifestyle only yesterday had seemed superficial and self-indulgent. Who was I to judge? It was none of my business how she made her peace with the world.
She'd fashioned a life out of tennis and shopping, but she managed to do occasional charity work, which was more than I could claim. She was right about one thing. The harm in the world is done by those who feel disenfranchised and abused. Contented people, as a rule, don't kite checks, rob banks, or kill their fellow citizens. I thought about going to the gym, but decided to bag that idea. I hadn't done a workout since Tuesday, but I just didn't give a damn. I puttered and napped through the middle of the day. At 3 o'clock, I took a long bubble bath. Well, I used my dishwashing liquid, but it did foam right up. I washed my hair and combed it for a change. I did some stuff to my face that passed for makeup in my book, and then wiggled into underwear and pantyhose. The dress was grand, and it fit like a charm, rustling the same way Olive's had the night before. I'd never had a role model for this female stuff. After my parents' death when I was 5, I'd been raised by a maiden aunt, no expert herself at things feminine. I'd spent the days of my childhood with cap guns and books, learning self-sufficiency, which loomed large with her. By the time I reached junior high, I was a complete misfit, and by high school I'd thrown in my lot with some badass boys who cussed and smoked dope, two things I mastered at an early age. In spite of the fact that I'm a social oaf, my aunt instilled a solid set of values, which prevailed in the end. By the time I graduated, I'd straightened up my act, and now I'm a model citizen, give or take a civil code or two. At heart, I've always been a prissy little moralist. Private investigation is just my way of acting out. By 4:30, I was standing on the Kohler's doorstep, listening to the door chime echo through the house. It didn't look as if anyone was there. There was mail jammed in the box, the newspaper and a brown paper-wrapped parcel on the mat. I peered into one of the long glass panels on either side of the front door. The foyer was dark, and no lights were showing at the rear of the house. Olive probably wasn't home from the supermarket yet. The cat appeared from around the side of the house with her long white coat and flat face. Somehow she seemed like a girl to me, but what do I know? I said some cat-type things. She appeared unimpressed. I heard a car horn toot. The electronic gate was rolled back from the driveway, and a white Mercedes 380 SL pulled in. Olive waved, and I moved toward the parking pad. She got out of the car and walked around to the rear, looking very classy in her white fur coat.
"Sorry I'm late. Have you been here long?"
5 minutes. She opened the trunk and picked up one grocery bag, then struggled to lift a second. "Here, let me help with that."
"Oh, thanks. Terry should be right behind me with the liquor."
I took the bag, snagging up another one while I was at it. There were 2 more in the trunk and another 2 bags visible in the front seat.
"God, how many people did you invite?" "Just 40 or so. It should be fun. Let's get these in and we'll have Terry bring the rest. We've got a ton of work to do."
She moved toward the front door while I brought up the rear. There was a crunch of tires on gravel, and Terry pulled into the drive in a silver-gray Mercedes sedan. Must be nice, I thought. The gate rolled shut. I waited while Olive emptied the mailbox and shoved the stack of envelopes in the top of her grocery bag. She picked up the newspaper and tucked that in, too, then grabbed the parcel. "You need help? I can take something else."
"I got it."
She laid the parcel across the bag, securing it with her chin while she fumbled for her house key. The cat was sauntering toward the driveway, plumed tail aloft. I heard the clink of liquor bottles as Terry set his bags down on the concrete. He began to coil up a garden hose the yardman had left on the walk.
"Break your neck on this thing," he said.
Olive got the door open and gave it a push. The telephone started to ring. I glanced back as she tossed the parcel toward the hall table. What happened next was too swift to absorb. There was a flash of light, a great burst that filled my visual field like a sun, followed by a huge cloud of white smoke. Shrapnel shot from a central point, spraying outward with a deadly velocity. A fireball seemed to curl across the threshold like a wall of water with a barrier removed, washing flames into the grass. Every blade of green in its path turned black. At the same time, I was lifted by a shattering low-frequency boom that hurtled me capriciously across the yard. I found myself sitting upright against a tree trunk like a rag doll, shoes gone, toes pointing straight up. I saw Olive fly past me as if she'd been yanked, tumbling in a high comic arc that carried her to the hedge and dropped her in a heap. My vision shimmered and cleared, a light show of the retina accompanied by the breathless thumping of my heart.
My brain, mute with wonder, failed to compute anything but the smell of black powder, pungent and harsh. The explosion had deafened me, but I felt neither fear nor surprise. Emotions are dependent on comprehension, and while I registered the event, nothing made any sense. Had I died in that moment, I would not have felt the slightest shred of regret, and I understood how liberating sudden death must be. This was pure sensation, with no judgment attached. The front wall of the house was gone, and a crater appeared where the hall table had been. The foyer was open to the air, surrounded by coronas of charred wood and plaster burning merrily. Large flakes of pale blue and pale brown floated down like snow. Grocery items littered the entire yard, smelling of pickles, cocktail onions, and scotch. I had taken in both sight and sound, but the apparatus of evaluation hadn't caught up with me yet. I had no idea what had happened. I couldn't remember what had transpired only moments before, or how this might relate to past events. Here we were in this new configuration, but how had it come to pass? From the change in light, I guessed that my eyebrows and lashes must be gone, and I was conscious of singed hair and flash burns. I put a hand up, amazed to find my limbs still functioning. I was bleeding from the nose, bleeding from both ears, where the pain was now excruciating. To my left, I could see Terry's mouth working, but no words were coming out. Something had struck him a glancing blow, and blood poured down his face. He appeared to be in pain, but the movie was silent, sound reel flapping ineffectually. I turned to see where Olive was. For one confused moment, I thought I saw a pile of torn foxes, their bloodied pelts confirming what she'd said the day before. It is true, I thought. These animals in the wild get ripped to shreds every day. The harsh splattering of red against the soft white fur seemed obscene and out of place. And then, of course, I understood what I was looking at. The blast had opened her body, exposing tangles of bloody flesh, yellow fat, and jagged bone along her backside. I closed my eyes. By then the smell of black powder was overlaid with the scent of wood smoke and cooked flesh. Carefully I pondered the current state of affairs. Olive had to be dead, but Terry seemed okay, and I thought perhaps at some point he would come and help me. No hurry, I thought. I'm comfy for now. The tree trunk provided back support, which helped, as I was tired. Idly I wondered where my shoes had gone. I sensed movement, and when I opened my eyes again, confused faces were peering into mine. I couldn't think what to say. I'd already forgotten what was going on, except that I was cold. Time must have passed. Men in yellow slickers pointed hoses at the house, swords of water cutting through the flames. Worried people crouched in front of me and worked their mouths some more. It was funny. They didn't seem to realize they weren't saying anything. So solemn, so animated, and so intent. Lips and teeth moving to such purpose with no visible effect. And then I was on my back, looking up into tree branches that wobbled through my visual field as I was borne away. I closed my eyes again, wishing that the reeling of the world would stop before I got sick. In spite of the fire, I was shivering. Chapter 15. Gradually my hearing returned, pale voices in the distance coming nearer, until I understood that it was someone bending over me. Daniel, as radiant as an archangel, appeared above me. The sight of him was baffling, and I felt an incredible urge to put a hand to my forehead, like a movie heroine recovering from a swoon, murmuring, "Where am I?" I was probably dead. Surely hell is having your former spouse that close again, flirting with a nurse. Ah, I thought, a clue. I was in a hospital bed. She was standing to his right, in polyester white, a vestal virgin with a bedpan, her gaze fixed on his perfect features and profile. I'd forgotten how cunning he was at that sort of thing. While he feigned grave concern for me, he was actually casting backward with his little sexual net, enveloping her in a fine web of pheromones. I moved my lips, and he leaned closer. He said, "I think she's conscious."